History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen as memories from way back take on new life in the here and now. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When it comes to that generation that served in World War II, 99%, this is the actual published data, 99% of the more than 16 million Americans who served in the war are no longer with us. Those who remain are either at or approaching the century mark, and an amazing vet who I've had the privilege of calling a friend for about a decade now is celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend. In visiting with him this week and thinking back on his life story, I was struck by something I guess I probably get desensitized to through all these years of interviewing veterans. What he survived during World War II, what he's endured since, and the fact that he's still going with as sharp a memory as ever at age 100 is something that has the potential to provide hope for the rest of us as we face some of the trials and tribulations that come our way. If we can persevere any way close to the way the gentleman we're going to hear from today did and hold on to that hope regardless of circumstances, maybe we'll have some pretty good stories to tell someday too, whether we make it to 100 or not. Niall Smith joined the Army Air Corps during World War II. It would become the Air Force by the time he served in the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. All told, more than 22 years in uniform. But he was born November 6th, 1922. That 100-year milestone arrives this weekend. So let's find out how he feels about hitting the century mark.
I never thought I'd make it. I never thought I'd be 100. But I don't know why I'm here. Somebody decides that. I feel all right. I mean, most of the time.
And you still have a full head of hair, and you still have your driver's license. So what's your secret?
I got a new driver's license a while back. I don't know. Maybe it's like the doctor said. I've never been a drinker or anything like that. I guess there's a lot of luck with it. But like the doctor said, I haven't abused my body. I've taken care of it.
What keeps you going? What keeps your mind engaged?
I do crosswords quite a bit. I don't watch TV much. Football season coming on, so I'll be watching that. I don't care too much for basketball or baseball, but I like the football. I started watching that, I guess, in about 1966, or when that really got organized. You remember some of the Dallas team? Jethro Pugh, I remember that.
Yeah.
Bob Lilly, he wasn't that big. Of course, he was big compared to us, but he was only about 6'2", 6'3". Uh-huh. He was strong. Quarterbacks was, Troy Aikman was a quarterback.
Yeah. I think you're going back to Roger Staubach, too, right?
I think he was the best quarterback he ever had. He was a Navy man. He had finishes to her there, but I think he was the best, and he was very religious. Just like the coach, Tom Landry. I remember one game, well, I've seen some here, they were two touchdowns behind, and he came in. I mean, he was just getting started. By God, they won the game.
Are you still following the Cowboys?
Well, kind of.
We could keep talking football. We could talk cars. He enjoys occasionally taking out his red Mercedes with that driver's license that's now good till he's 105. But wait till you hear some of what he's lived through over this last century. We'll start out with his childhood near Decatur, Illinois.
There's a small town called La Place, Illinois. And I was raised on a farm. Me and my dad were a farmer.
What'd you guys grow?
Corn, soybeans, wheat, clover. For cows and everything.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Six brothers, no sisters.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a lot of hands on the farm then.
Yeah. Of course, they're not all at the same time, but there's over three or four boys there to help do the farming and the work.
So it sounds like that occupied a lot of your time then growing up.
Yeah, it sure did. As far as the cows were concerned, or animals, you got to be there 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to be there. feed them and take care of them and all that.
So as you're going through high school and all that, were you dreaming of getting off the farm at some point and going somewhere else?
Not really. Well, yeah. I was going to go to college. I graduated from high school in 1940. And I had a scholarship to a college in Carthage, Illinois. But then the war came along, so that was that.
Yeah, you were you had just celebrated your 19th birthday about a month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were when you found out about that?
Yes. You never forget a thing like that. Well, we were in a lay place there in the farmhouse in a dining room. It was about, or when we heard about it, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sitting there listening to the radio. My dad was over in the corner in the rocking chair asleep, and the announcement came on. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. All military personnel, if you're on leave or wherever you are, get back to your bases immediately. So I woke my dad up and told him, what? He couldn't believe it, see?
Did that hit you like a ton of bricks? Was that a pretty big deal?
Well, it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. It was hard to believe, you know. So then I went into service in January of 42.
So you weren't waiting around to get drafted. You said, I want to do something?
Well, I didn't want to be in the Army, really, because, you know, they had a lot of time on the ground and everything. So either the Air Force or the Navy. So I enlisted in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. How many of your brothers ended up serving in the war?
Okay, two others during the war. Altogether, there were five of us brothers that had been in the service.
Wow.
Four of us have retired from the service.
Not too many veterans I get to interview who served in both World War II and the Vietnam War, but that's the case for Niall. We're going to hear about that. And you mentioned the other brothers that were in World War II. Did they make it home as well?
Yeah, everybody made it home.
You had quite the odds to beat to make it home yourself. We're going to get to that. But let's talk about those early days in the Army Air Corps. Did you go in hoping that you could become a pilot? Because most guys that did something in the Army Air Corps say they wanted to be pilots.
Well, yeah, I wanted to be a pilot, but at that time you got to have education.
Mm-hmm.
I think now it's 4 years, but at that time it was 2 years. So I knew I couldn't be a pilot. So I said, well, I'll be a gunner or something like that, be on an air crew. At the time I applied, that was all filled up, so I couldn't get that. So I ended up being a mechanic. I went to mechanic school.
Mm-hmm. Little did you know what was ahead of you. Little did you know some of the adventures you would have, the close calls you would have. That it wasn't just medals you brought home from the war. You brought home something that's lasted a lot longer and been a lot more important to you. We'll get to that before we're done. But when you say a mechanic in the Army Air Corps, what did that mean you were responsible for, and how much responsibility did you feel?
Well, you went to aircraft mechanic school on a B-17. Of course, we didn't know what kind of planes we were going to be or working on or assigned to. Then, we found out it was going to be B-17s. There was about five men on a ground crew. There's always a crew chief, assistant crew chief, and then two or three other guys. You start out just ground crew, but I ended up being assistant crew chief. Of course, that takes several years to get up to that. But it's B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
And our group was formed, the 96 Bomb Group was formed in Walla Walla, Washington. And our commander at that time was Archie J. Olds. He was a colonel. He was later on, after the war and everything, he was in charge of 15th Air Force at March Air Force Base. He was a general, some kind of general.
And from going on the farm with your brothers to at these different bases with all these guys from all over the country, was that a bit of an eye-opener for you?
Oh, yeah. Started out in Walla Walla, Washington, was there a month. Rapid City, South Dakota for a month. Pocatello, Idaho for 2 months, I think. And then we got on a train and we went clear down around through California thing to Paoli, Texas. And that base was built, we just finished building it. And we were there about 3.5 months, and they were continuing the training to go overseas. We didn't know where we'd go, but ended up being England.
And I want to talk to you about getting over to England and about what you brought back from England. But the B-17, to be responsible for it operating the way it needs to, I mean, you've got men's lives in your hands every time that plane goes up, don't
you? That's right. Been some nights we worked all night to make sure it's right or, you know, get something done so that they could have the plane for the next day.
Was there part of that? When you go through all your checks and make sure this is operating right and this is moving right and that's running right, Was there one part of that that gave you the most trouble or that was the hardest to make sure it was doing what it was supposed to do?
Well, probably the hardest thing was getting there, like when you changed an engine. And then you've got to put all the accessories like carburetor and fuel pump and everything else on the new engine, transfer that over, and then hang the thing and get it adjusted to the right RPM and make sure that everything is working like it's supposed to work.
Because if it's not, that could cost some people their lives.
Well, that's right. That engine could quit or go out.
So was that fulfilling work for you?
Well, it was at the time. Sure. Just made sure you did the job right. I remember during the war, like in England, lots of nights we were working nighttime. We didn't have big floodlights and everything else. There's a war going on. We use flashlights. You hear a plane overhead, you turn the light out. Because they said that a plane from 10,000 feet can see a cigarette on the ground.
Wow. Sounds pretty tense.
Yeah, lots of night.
What about the journey over to England? Was that an adventure for you?
Oh, yeah. We got on the train at Pouty up through Fort Worth and Dallas. And at that time, the space between Dallas and Fort Worth, there might have been 20 miles or so. No people. But now it's all one big city. Anyway, then we went up to New York, and we left from Pier 50 on the Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. And right beside where the Queen Elizabeth was, here was the Normandy lying on its side. Somebody had sabotaged it, and it burned.
That's encouraging.
So, yeah. So then we got on the ship, and it took us 6 days to go across. They changed course every 7 minutes, zigzag. And the only people that knew the course was the captain and the navigator. They did that because of the subs. 15,000, 18,000 troops on that one ship, 24 hours in the stateroom, 24 hours on deck. A stateroom that would normally have maybe two or three or four people, here's maybe 18 people assigned to that one room, about four high, you know. I know the first night I went out, had to go out on deck, it started raining. So what do you do then? You pick up all your stuff and go and get out of the lounge someplace.
Do you remember what it felt like emotionally? I mean, were you concerned that you might not see America again?
Well, not really. Young people, they're full of energy and they don't think about things like that. They just want to get in the middle of everything and they don't think about dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't think about it until it actually happens, or something happens, and you think you might.
And before you went over there, did you think that your job was going to be a pretty safe job, comparatively speaking?
Well, yeah, but England was getting bombed too. See, And the first night we were in England, our base got bombed.
Wow! Welcome to the war.
And we hadn't had any. We didn't have any shelters or anything else. When anything set up as a new base, see, here was guys diving through hedges to be in a ditch, get in a ditch, stuff like that.
Where'd you go?
I just found a low spot and got in it. But there wasn't anybody killed or anything.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how old were you?
Well, I'd be 20, I guess, 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So then your bombers start flying their missions. And tell us what your duty was like those first few weeks and months that you were over there.
Well, we had to get them ready. If they came back, either bomb damage or engine out, something like that, we'd change an engine overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take maybe 6-8 hours. And we heard that the Germans could change an engine in 15 minutes. They had all quick disconnects and everything else. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We had hoses and clamps and all kind of stuff. Anyway, you just keep them ready, and they always called. They said they need so many planes. We got to have so many planes. So there's lots of times we worked all night, to get one ready. Even changing outer wing panels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How did the pilots and the crews of those bombers treat you?
They treated us good, and they depended on us too. Like the original pilots that we took over there, I mean, they knew what was going on, and they knew that, or they depended on us, and they got to know the ground crew and all that, because you can't have a plane, something happening on the flight. So, yeah, they appreciated it.
And you mentioned having to fix damaged engines or patch up damaged planes. Was that a pretty frequent occurrence? I mean, was it rare for a group of bombers to come back unscathed?
It was rare for them to, very rare for them to come back unscathed until about, it had to be in 44 before the P-51s got over there to where they could go all the way on the mission.
With as escort, yeah.
Right, as escort. Up to that time, they can only go halfway, like a P-47, they go halfway and they have to turn around. Then you're at the mercy, and here's a German fighter sitting out there waiting, see? So when they came back, there was holes. Of course, you had sheet metal men, that was their job. There was holes, there was half a tail shot off, you know, and stuff like that. So there was lots of damage, and we knew that that's how it would be. It would fly almost.
Did you ever look at a plane and say, I don't know how that one made it back?
Yeah, yeah. We had one, it wasn't our plane, let's see. Part of the tail was gone, two engines were out, the third one was going out. So actually he only had about one engine, one and a half engine. And he made it back, and when it landed, the gear gave out and he just slid, you know. They said if it hadn't been for the pilots, they wouldn't have made it.
It's time for our first break, but wait until you hear what Niall Smith survived and the lives he saved in the process during a nightmare scenario in the air over England that even at age 100, he remembers as vividly as ever. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video with Niall. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.